excellent most people are in. I know a few people have always asked about, they asked again this evening, about bringing your children to the meditation class or the Dharma talk afterwards. They're most welcome as long as they can keep quiet. But we do have like a room to the right here, just between here and the reception area. Usually they still have the talk, the speakers in there, yeah. So any mums or dads or something who are concerned their kids may make a bit of noise but they still want to come, you can go into the room next door. The kid can make as much noise as they want, as long as you know that it's loud enough in here and you can listen to the talk as well. A lot of time the children, when they come here, they pick up on the energy and they become quiet and peaceful too. So I've been really impressed with some of the children who have been brought here. And they just learn about how to keep quiet and meditate. And this one little girl, she started meditating here when she was only 7 years of age. And she would sit perfectly still for half an hour, crossed her legs, never moved. Just an amazing little meditator, ever since she was seven. So that really said, well, you know, if you can be quiet, yeah, come along and just meditate. So, but anyway, that's not the topic of this evening's talk. This evening, I'm always wondering what I'm going to speak about, and always want to try and make it relevant. So this is not just theoretical religion, you know, it's up there what's going to happen to you after you die. You know, that's a bit unprovable. Instead, we say, you know, how one can live a happier, peaceful, more successful life right now, and how can these principles, age-old principles which has made Buddhism a world religion and kept it relevant for so many centuries, how can we use these in our modern world? And trying to think of a good subject for this evening, because I've talked about so much in my life, so I remembered that there's, for me anyway, there's a confluence of three things happening. Tomorrow we have the election for our state government here in Western Australia. On Monday I travel to Canberra for a meeting of what we call the Australian Sangha Association. Sangha means monks and nuns, where we have our annual AGM. This is a little society which I founded to bring all the monks and nuns of all traditions, all genders, male and female, together, so we can work together. If people of religion can't work together, who can? So we have our AGM on Tuesday, and as the President was saying, on then Saturday, another AGM and elections for our Buddhist society here. So I was reminded, because that some years ago, I gave a talk at the United Nations Day of Waisak in Bangkok, a keynote address on the subject. They gave me the subject of good governance and Buddhism. And I thought it would be an excellent opportunity to how these Buddhist principles apply to governance. And governance doesn't just mean of a country. It also means of any societies, whether it's your local bridge club or soccer club or this Buddhist society here. The governance of, you know, that your department, where you work, you know, your bosses and workers, and even just of a small unit like a family. You know, how do we actually get things done in a Buddhist way? And of course, when it's bad governance, it causes so much suffering for us, an unavoidable waste of opportunities, waste of resources, and sometimes that. No, we look back afterwards, why couldn't we have got our act together and done something much better? And so, because you know, Buddhism has been around a long time, there's a lot we can actually contribute to good governance at all levels of our society, even governing your own life. So, this is going to be the talk today, and one of the other reasons I give this talk is few people realize that the oldest, continuous, democratic tradition in our world, very clear to demonstrate, is this order of Buddhist monks and nuns. We've been going for 2,500 years, continuously, running on a democratic tradition. Many people think that I am the boss, and sometimes that for our Buddhist society, one person, I think he's sitting in the back over there somewhere, he sort of said, I'm not really the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, but the spiritual dictator. But you know, that's not always true, because I do get outvoted very often. And even in a monastery, an abbot does not have the same power as in a Christian monastery, where everyone has to be obedient. It's not the way it works. That in a monastery, a Buddhist monastery, it is democracy. So when anything comes up, any suggestion, we have to discuss it, we vote on it. But it's a little bit different than the way of governance in the Westminster political system. Everybody has their say, and instead of, if we vote on it, if it's not unanimous, we have to carry on discussing. So what happens, you know, maybe the first round, we get an idea of how people feel, and if you're obviously in the minority, if you're outvoted, then we follow the system of agree to disagree. So we vote for the proposal, even though we have misgivings about it, because we know the majority is for the proposal. And that feeling of harmony is so important. But everyone has their say first of all. But no decision can be made if one monk objects to it, feels so strongly about it that they don't want to proceed with it. So we carry on discussing until such time as that monk realizes, well, I've had my say, I disagree with you guys, but you're in the majority, I will go with the majority out of faith that I may be wrong. Which is one of the things that we are trained. I was trained, and hopefully I'm training the other monks, to realize and keep in mind all the time that even though you think you are right, sometimes it turns out that you got it wrong and you made a big mistake. How many times in your life have you been absolutely sure that you were right and it turns out that you were mistaken, you were wrong? Admit that. So we're never that stubborn to always think we're right and to go against what other people say. And in fact, in Buddhism, we never even think we're right and the other person's wrong. We always remember, and I'm not going to repeat it at length, the really great, famous, wonderful simile of the elephant and the blind men. And if you haven't heard that before, you've been living under a rock, and this must be your first time here. Even when I went over some years ago to a big conference, you know, with all these big politicians like Rudd and Gillard and Wayne Swan and Brumby and other people, even some guy came up and said this in front of the politicians, that he had to tell them, look, stop arguing. And, you know, they very briefly, seven blind men went to see an elephant. They'd never seen an elephant before. They felt a different part of the elephant. Because they felt different parts of the elephant, one guy said an elephant's a tree trunk because he felt the legs. Another one said it was a plow because it felt the tusk. Another one said it was a fly whisk because it felt the tail. Another one said it was a fang because it felt the ears. The point was, they all thought they were right. And they were right to a certain extent. You know, if you actually feel the ear of an elephant moving backwards and forwards, you may perceive it's a fan. And if you've only felt the legs, you think, no way, you're wrong. It's a tree trunk. Now, when you stand back and get the bigger picture, you know that they were all right, but they were also wrong. That's what my teacher always said. Whenever there's an argument between two people, two monks, he would say, you are right, but not correct. And you are correct, but not right. To say that, you know, it's not a black and white, right and wrong, you're in between most times. Because each person has got a fraction, just a part of the truth. Not the whole truth. No one can really get that whole truth. They get part of it. Another person's got another part of it. And sometimes we argue over those different parts of the truth we have. And the elephant simile, it just makes it very, very clear that instead of arguing with one another, instead of contrasting our experiences, instead we combine them. So, what is an elephant to blind men? An elephant is this big rock, that's its body, on four tree trunks with a fly whisk at the back. On the front of that rock, above a little bit, is another big water pot with two fans on either side, two ploughs and a big snake in the middle. That's if you combine your experiences instead of fighting against one another. So this is actually what we say about how, you know, we come together and we govern. We don't have conflict, but we listen to one another. And I try and find out what this monk feels and why he feels it. And he tries to find out what I feel. We combine our experiences, our views, so we can get a much broader picture than I could ever see by myself. Which means it's much closer to the truth, be much more successful. We don't have these terrible arguments. So that's how our democracy works. And of course, that's just, you know, how governance should work, you know, wherever we are. You know, when we do make decisions in life, we don't make decisions alone. Sometimes that's far too much responsibility for one person. And of course, people make terrible decisions that way. So instead, we gather as much information as possible by really listening to other people. Never thinking we are right. Never thinking we've got the final answer. Even in medicine, there was one great scientist. I've never met him, but I heard of him. To me, I was trained as a scientist. Now, this is a scientist, and that was that fellow. He was a head of medicine in Royal Prince Alfred Hospital, and he welcomed this intake of medical students. This is where I heard this from one of the medical students. The first day that he was in medical school in Sydney, this great professor, about to retire, welcomed everybody and said to them, "What we're about to teach you in the next 4 years, 50% of it is wrong. I know that. What we're going to teach you as medical fact is wrong, 50% of it. My problem is I don't know which 50% it is." Now that's a scientist. Always open to seeing another angle, something new. For most people in our world, truth is only a temporary, you know, as best we know. It's work in action. It is never finished. And if you understand that and embrace that in your life, it stops a lot of arguments. We're always willing to listen to others. And it's one of the reasons I really tried hard in my life. It's difficult. I really tried hard in my life to hang out with people who aren't Buddhists, if I possibly can. Because I know, being a Buddhist monk, senior Buddhist monk, well known, I can get so narrow-minded because I don't get the feedback from people who are totally different than I am. And that's why I did make some great, great, great connections, especially with people of other religions. And one of those people, I mean, there's bad news about them, but that was a long time ago. This monk wasn't involved in the New Norcia monks. And the old Abbot Placid, who was a really good mate of mine. And we had some wonderful times together. I was mentioning this about all the ceremonies which people have. This is a type of religion with very, very few ceremonies. Because what a waste of time ceremonies are. A little bit of ceremony, maybe, but not too much. And, you know, I did go, was got an invite to the ordination of the first female bishop in any Christian church in the world. And that was Kate Galsworthy here in Perth. Don't know if you know that. That was historic. The very first bishop in any Christian church in the world was ordained in this city. So I said, yeah, I'm into going to that, supporting that. And so we went there, and I was sitting next. They put us, the mostly Christian Anglicans there, put me in the heretics pew. That's what I called it. I was sitting next to Abbot Placid from New Norcia and the head of the Uniting Church, the three of us. Honestly, we were like naughty school children, you know, but because we were, you know, honoured guests. They couldn't throw us out of the church, although we deserved to, because the ceremony lasted for 2 hours. 2 hours of ceremonies. And after about a quarter of an hour, half an hour of that, I started telling jokes to Albert Placid. And he's as good as I am. He's told his jokes back to me. We're having a great time laughing together in church. A Buddhist monk and a Catholic. I look back upon that with great fun. But the point was that only if you can actually listen to other people's views and get their ideas, can you actually get a much wider view. So with governance, you know, we have to take feedback and actually welcome feedback. I'm not just just playing games, but really do it carefully. Listen to other people. Try and really get into their heads and feel what they're feeling or why they're feeling it as best you possibly can. It's difficult to do, but try it. And feel what it's like, you know, to be sort of like a gay person. You know, I'm not gay, I was heterosexual. But when somebody came up to me once, years ago, and they said religion has been so cruel to the gay community, whoa, that just got into me. It's still there, it's like a knife inside of me. When they said that, because they said that with so much emotion, I felt it. And so, well, if you feel something like that, and you really empathize, you really got into them, they got into you, then you feel, no way will I ever sort of stop supporting that community, whatever way I can possibly do. You know, you hear somebody else's truth, which is very hard for you to understand. And you get to someone who's been sexually abused or been violated. You feel that. You've got to empathize. You've got to expand your experience of this great elephant which we call life. And that way, that you can, it's amazing what we can do when we don't fight each other, but we join together with a simile of the elephant. That is good governance. It's taking feedback. It's not personal feedback. It's just feedback about this world, about life. It's about us. You know that old simile? Which again, it just guides my life. You know, when it came from marriages, it's an old simile, but it comes in here. It's very beautiful. I've done very many marriages here, together with Dennis in the back. He knows that I always say this little anecdote. Looking into the new bride's eyes, you're a married woman now, you can't think of yourself anymore. Yes, she says. And then look at the groom, you're a married man now, you can't think of yourself. And he hesitates, but he comes around eventually and says yes. Honestly, that's anecdotally true. I'm not being gender specific, that's my experience of hundreds of marriages. And then still looking at the guy, you're a married man now, you mustn't think of yourself, nor must you think of your new wife. And then I look at her. And said, you're a married woman now, you must never ever again from this point on think of him. And that's a beautiful moment for me, because if you haven't heard this story before, you think, you're confused, what on earth is this monk talking about? And that's when you give the answer, and it's a very profound answer. He said, when you're married, you must never think of yourself, nor must you ever think of your partner. You must only ever think of us. The third option, which too many people miss in a marriage, it's never about me. It's never about your partner. It's about us. You're in it together. So when you understand that, you understand why in a government, it's never about my party or your party. It's always about us. And you have responsibility to run this country together. In your Buddhist society, whoever gets elected to be, you know, the president, the secretary, we've got to listen to one another, and we're running it together. We're involved in it. In a monastery, it's never about me. It's never about the other monks. It's always about us. When you understand that, it changes perspective. So you listen to each other, and it's almost like you just become just one animal with many legs. And that means that you always know if you're an elephant with four legs, if the back leg's going one direction and the front leg's going another direction, where do you get? It's called gridlock. You get nowhere. So we always have to go in the same direction. And that's actually what we do. We listen, we learn, And the other thing is, again, pride has got nothing to do with it. We always talk about in Buddhism about anatta, non-self. There is not a self in here. So the whole idea of ego just doesn't make any sense to me. Okay, sometimes, as I only learned this word from Dennis, he said sometimes I Skype, tell people all the amazing things which I get up to and the nice letters I get. It's not about me. You know that once, this is not Skyping, that this is a true sort of anecdote. You know, when I started getting famous and then I went over to give a talk in Singapore, I remember this talk, it was in the Suntec Convention Centre, 5,000 people. And there's no support, just one person right in the front, that was me. You know, like sometimes if you're a musician, you've got your band behind you, you've got support acts, you've got an MC, just only yourself, by yourself, all these people coming to see you. Spending an evening where they're very, very busy. So responsibility for me to actually inspire them, entertain them, but not just inspiration and entertainment. They can go back with something very useful for their lives. Otherwise, what's the point of them coming? And realize there's a lot of responsibility there, and I thought, it's not me. I'm not doing this. It was my teacher, his training. And so it wasn't me. I never took any personal responsibility for it, because it was just this whole process of how monks get trained, how you get trained by your parents, by your teachers, by your culture, to actually to be amazing, wonderful people. It's never looked upon as being personal achievement anymore. It's just part of this amazing process, like many monks, many politicians, many presidents in the past have done. You just go out there and do it. Never actually thinking that somehow it enhances who you are or demeans who you are. Never ever think like that. So when we take the ego out of politics, what a wonderful thing that is. So it's not a person anymore. It is the policies. We always even have that. It's a powerful part in Buddhism, which I of course first saw it and hit me very hard, which is why I remember it. It's in I'll even quote it for you, the Ranavibhanga Sutta. He said, whenever you criticize anybody, you don't ever criticize a person. You only criticize the act. That's all. And that's what it said in the sutta, and I got a much better metaphor, simile for that many, many years later, and it's in Opening the Door of Your Heart. It's the two children at the supermarket simile. Two children in parallel aisles of a supermarket, and one just, you know, carelessly or just by accident, they dropped a carton of milk. It went splat on the floor. You may have seen that happen. Another kid, almost exactly the same time, in a parallel aisle in the checkout aisles, dropped a jar of honey and it smashed on the floor. And the important thing is, was the reactions of the mothers. One mother said to the child, "You stupid child, you dropped the carton of milk." And the other mother said, "That was a stupid thing you did." Now you probably experienced that yourself sometime in your life as a kid, at work, from your partner in the marriage or in a relationship. Somebody calls you stupid. How does that feel? Or someone just says that's a stupid thing you did. How does that feel? One focuses on the act. It's a stupid thing you did. Not you. You're not a bad person. You're not a stupid person. You did a stupid act. We all do that from time to time. I've done plenty of stupid things in my life. Okay, another stupid thing which I did in my life. I was supposed to be mindful and wise. I once left monastery down at Serpentine, coming here to give a talk one evening. And my driver, I said, "Oh my goodness, I've forgotten my glasses, I better go back." And he said, "Ajahn Brahm, look on your nose." And he was right. I forgot they're actually here. I'm sure you've done stupid things like that. And I've done lots of stupid things in my life. Oh, I love talking about my stupid things instead of the smart things. At that time, again, you know, I live in a different world than most people, in a monastery. So sometimes the, you know, modern things which happen, I just miss. So the time in Penang after a meditation retreat, just before I boarded my flight, they took me to the cafe to give this, you know, very, you know, sweet coffee, sweet milky coffee. I don't know what it was, but it's delicious. Probably really terrible for your health, but who cares? You're going to die anyway. You can always get reincarnated. But anyway, and so I tried to suck it through the straw. And, you know, for bad luck, I got a straw, which something was wrong with it. It was, you know, either crimped or it was blocked. So I sucked harder and harder. And my face was going red. You know, when you really suck really hard, try and get the blockage out. People respect me too much. Instead of telling me I was doing a stupid thing, they just, you know, were sitting there quietly just watching what was going to happen next, trying to stop laughing, until I had to find out for myself, because they really started giggling and they could hold back no longer. It was a spoon. Now, a plastic spoon, which they have in coffee shops. When I grew up, spoons were metal, and the handle was flat, not just like a stick. Have a look next time you see some of these, you know, spoons you have in coffee shops. They do look like a straw to a monk. Really unfair. It's such a stupid thing, which, you know, you do. So anyway, that's fair enough. But so, you know, we all do stupid things. And so we just, you know, it's not me, it's just my conditioning, that's all. How would I know? Oh, here we go, number three, and I'll stop at number three. Just in the community hall over there, a wedding. So, you know, I was supposed to do a wedding, and this the bride came in, you know, with the father-in-law, this old Australian man. And, you know, as she came in, I said, "Oh, you're the father-in-law." And he looked at me, and just his face was just so angry and upset. He said, "No, I am the groom." But honestly, he was old enough to be the grandfather-in-law. But that was the end of any donations for that wedding. So, you know, you make mistakes, but you laugh at them and you share them because, you know, you don't have any sort of ego to protect. In fact, it's nice when you don't, so you can share all your mistakes as well as the nice things which happen to you. But, you know, when actually you want some good governance, is, first of all, decision-making has to be done in the proper way. Get the information together, not from ignorance. There's something which the Buddha talked about, he called it the four agati. This is actually real Buddhism, you know, as the Buddha taught it. Never make decisions based out of four things. No personal interest, ill will, stupidity or fear. And that was brilliant, because I noticed so many times people make, "What's in it for me?" So in good governance, it's never "what's in it for me," it's what's in it for us. Now, if it's in a monastery, for our Buddhist monastery, for the whole monastery, what's in it for the country? What's in it for the Buddhist Society of Western Australia? Not for me, it's not personal anymore. And I'm actually very proud, and I'm saying this before the AGM, every sort of committee member I've ever worked with, everyone is just so selfless. And they just sacrifice so much of their time and their energy. And sadhu, sadhu, sadhu to all of you who have served in our committee or are going to serve in it in the future. The amount of time you give is immense. And you don't get anything out of it at all, except headaches and lots of emails complaining. It's true. But anyway, it's nice to be able to give. You just take that on the chin. But anyway, it's nothing in it personally. And also, never any ill will. Someone disagrees with you. Listen to them. Why? And see if you can find some common ground. You know, increase your understanding of what an elephant is. You know, how we can make progress and how people work. And all opportunities are all opportunities for growth. So whenever there's any conflict is a place where we can learn a bit more. Somebody's seeing things in a different way than I am. So I want to find out why. Why do you feel like that when I feel something different? I want to grow, I want to learn from this. So conflict is never anything negative, it's just a positive to me. I want to find out why. Why do you feel like that? What do you really want? Old story again. Two people, they were fighting over an orange. In their house, they only had one orange left. And one person said, it's my turn, you had the last orange. Oh, but you had the last two, so I should have these two. There's only one orange left. You know what they did? They argued and argued, so they came to a compromise. They cut the orange in half. And one of the persons, they peeled the orange, the half an orange, they threw the peel in the trash can, and they ate the flesh. And the other person peeled their half of the orange, and they threw the flesh into the trash can, because they needed the peel to make a cake. If they'd only discussed what they wanted, why? Instead of arguing, then one person could have had twice as much flesh to eat and the other person twice as much peel for their cake. How many times do we argue like that? What do you really want? When you find out what people want, it's usually no problem, because people are usually very reasonable and, you know, good-hearted. So this is actually where, you know, we don't argue, we find out, using conflict to find out why. And it's wonderful we have governance like that. Now when we have the governance like that, if you do have a conflict, as I said earlier, we don't criticize the person. It's not a bad thing, you're not stupid. Maybe, you know, I disagree with you, but I want to find out why. So all this, we call them ad hominem, this when our leaders, whether it's politics or in a family, or in a business, they call each other stupid, idiots, selfish. To me, just, oh, surely you should grow up and just, you may criticize the ideas, but no, never criticize a person. I've been around too long, I've never ever seen a bad person. This is an old simile, going to prisons, seeing famous criminals. One of the most famous criminals I ever saw was this London gangster, Ronnie Cray. You know what Ronnie Cray said to me when I saw him in Broadmoor Prison Hospital for the Criminally Insane? He shook my hand and said, if I ever get a couple of quid, I'll send it to your monastery. He actually wanted to make a donation, you know, to the Buddhist Society of West Australia. He never did, he never got a couple of quid. He was in jail. But, you know, he has a bit of kindness in him. And he's notorious, what that man did. And I've been seeing some amazing people. I've been in many prisons, I've never seen a criminal. Not once. I've seen people who've committed crimes, but that's not a criminal. They're a person who did something wrong. They're not a wrong person. Stupid thing they did. They're not stupid people. And I don't know if I told this, I probably told this last week, because I give so many talks, but down in Carnet Prison Farm, close to where we live, I think many of the monks go down there to teach, and this, apparently last year there was a prisoner down there, the end of his sentence, and he'd read my book, The Opening the Door of Your Heart. He'd really got really into that first story, the two bad bricks in the wall. You know, instead of just destroying a wall because of two bad bricks, remember there's 998 good bricks as well. So it's just a wall with two bad bricks. It's not a bad wall, it's a wall with two bad bricks, that's all. And he goes around saying, it was only two murders, that's all. It's only two murders, that's all. It really related to that story because he'd done so many other beautiful things in his life. He wasn't a murderer. So when he is probably free now, he will never re-offend. If he thinks he's a murderer, that's who he is, that's what he does, he'll do it again. If he's a person who's done two bad things, very bad things, when he gets released, he doesn't need to do it again. See the difference there? When a person called you stupid, if you believed them, you became stupid. It's a stupid thing you do. You focus on that bad thing you've done, and you stop doing it again. You learn from mistakes because you're not a bad person. You grow from them and do it better next time. So this is actually what I mean, that we don't criticize people that much in good governance. So not ill will. We don't make decisions out of anger, ill will, not stupidity, and most of all not out of fear. Because a lot of times people are afraid to make decisions about whether you'll be re-elected or not. Most people in our Buddhist society are not really afraid of being not elected. If they're not elected, they think, oh, phew, I got out of that one. That's a great service to do these things. But you can see how people run out of fear. What would other people think of me? Really great leaders who can really govern have this great vision, and they're going to do it. They don't care what really happens to them. They're going to just do it anyway. And sometimes they sacrifice their life for that. No, I remember this. One of the greatest politicians. He was president of Egypt. You know, after the six-year war after the six-year war with Israel, you know, it was a big problem between Egypt and Israel, and he just, without any warning, he just got on an aircraft and flew to Jerusalem to talk with, I think Begin was the Israeli Prime Minister. What was this guy's name again? Sadat, that's right, Anwar Sadat. He made peace. And he got assassinated for that about 6 months or a year later, willing to give up his life to save the lives of so many people. And that was the one who had some leadership and no fear, even if it's going to cost him his life, cost him his position. Let's do this anyway. Those are the leaders who are inspirational. The people who do have a vision and they're not afraid of what it might cost them. Because they know it's really good, it's wonderful. And that's with good governance. You know, the reason why we govern, why we put in leadership positions, in this little book or speech which I wrote, there's three types of leadership. You know, when you have the authority because you're elected, but you have innate authority because of who you are, or you get like assumed authority when you take authority. The elected authority, that is, you know, you got some power because people have chosen you. And they've chosen you because they've looked at you and they thought, yes, you are good to be able to be a president of our Buddhist society, to be the premier of our state, to be, you know, the leader of this part of the company. And people select you. And at this particular time when there's an election here in Western Australia, I always put people back to the times of the Roman Empire, the Senate, if you know your history. Because in the Roman Senate, if you were standing for election, you had to wear white clothes throughout the period of election until the election was over. That was showing that you were standing for the Senate in Rome. The word for white in Latin is candid. And from that we get the word candidate today. A candidate comes from the word white from the Roman times, when anyone standing for election had to wear white. And the reason they wore white was a symbol of their virtue, their purity, their good conduct. It's the same reason why even today in marriages, traditional marriages, the woman always wears white as a symbol of her purity and virtue, I hope. And the groom always wears black as a symbol of, well, you can think that one out yourself. That's where it comes from. So even you can see that in monasteries, we still have that. If you're keeping eight precepts, like we have a few eight preceptors usually come on the weekend, they wear white clothes. That's a symbol of like purity, you know, keeping the utter seal. You wear white, it's tradition. So because of that, that's where we get the word candidate from. And they were candidates because they had a good reputation. They were elected on not what they're going to promise for the future. No one knows that. But what they've done in the past. And I often thought, wouldn't it be wonderful when we elect people for the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, or for the company you're working for, or for any position of authority in governance, that they are elected on their past conduct, not on their future promises. Come on, why do we always believe in promises? Especially as Buddhists, anicca, impermanence, you don't know the future. Who knows what's going to happen? How can you promise something when you don't know what the situation is going to be like in 1 month's time, let alone 6 months or a year's time? But we still get sucked into that. Believing promises when promises can never be affirmed. So look, I never actually blame, I've known a lot of politicians in my life, and I never blame a politician for breaking promises. I blame politicians for making promises in the first place. You should never make the promises. Instead, run on your past conduct. So this is actually when we elected people, and if you elect them on the past conduct, then you got some authority. But you know, there are some people who have what I call innate authority. They're real leaders, simply because of this, who they are and how they've acted. You know, a person like a Churchill. But you know, that Winston Churchill, I don't know how many of you know this also. It's great being a monk. You get all this interesting information which not many other people know about. One of our monks many years ago from Australia, he was visiting England, and his host said, oh, we'll take you to a castle. You've never seen an English castle before. Is that a good time to do the castle joke? Okay, I haven't done a joke yet. This is an old joke. I'm sure I've said this about 6 months ago, but I'm banking on the point that you don't remember it. There's an Australian girl. She told me she'd just been on holiday in England. And she went to one of these castles. If you're Australian, never been to England before, you have to go to a castle. You don't have castles in Australia. Real old, 600, 700 year old castles. With huge banqueting halls and dungeons, the whole works. So she was taken through this old castle. And it was really spooky. You know, even if you didn't believe in ghosts, you know, you start, you know, feeling a bit creepy. Because, you know, in these old castles, you know, the wind would whistle, you know, through the gaps in the windows. That's pretty good special effects, isn't it? And all the floorboards would creak, and even the doors, as they would open. And so she's getting more and more scared. You know, even though she didn't believe in ghosts and spirits and the supernatural and that sort of stuff, when it got to the end of the tour, she couldn't help ask the guide. He said, are there any ghosts in this castle? And the guide looked at her and said, look, in all the years I've lived in this castle, I've never ever met a ghost. She said, how long have you lived here? He said, about 400 years. He was a ghost. But anyway, the castle was closed. No, even the castle was closed one day, give the ghost the rest. So the host was thinking, where can I take this monk to? And just close by was the country estate of Winston Churchill, the wartime Prime Minister of England, called Chartwell. And that happened to be open. So I'll take you to this place. So as they went in the entrance there, the monk noticed at the entrance was a big picture, a painting of the Buddha. And he asked, what's this doing here? And the curator said, this was painted by Sir Winston Churchill. And this is a painting of the Buddha. It was a Burmese Buddha statue, Burmese style, of the Buddha, which was by Winston Churchill's bed, on his bedside table throughout the Second World War. He kept that by his table to give him some peace, inspiration. You know, he suffered from depression to try and uplift his spirits throughout the Second World War. And his wife, Clementine, apparently she had a statue of the Goddess of Mercy Kuan Yin next to her bedside throughout the Second World War. They were closet Buddhists, maybe, I don't know, but they never came out. They had Buddha statues there, and that's what we found. And that's amazing, some of the stuff which you find out about sort of some of these people. But anyhow, that a good leader is inspirational. Because I remember my parents at that time, that guy Churchill could actually give a speech and it would inspire everybody. You know, he had that gift to actually of leadership, where you just go in front of whoever, you know, is working for you, and afterwards you inspire them, they just want to do everything for you. And that brings me to one of the core principles of leadership from the Chinese Art of War. You know, it's not really a war manual, but just about life. It's by Sung Po, very, very great book. The general with the best discipline in the Imperial Army. And the emperor just summoned him. Why do your troops always follow instructions? Always, no matter what you ask them to do. And the general replied, very simply, Your Majesty, it's because I only ever tell them to do what they want to do. That's why they always follow my orders. So how can soldiers want to go into battle knowing they'll probably die or get seriously injured? How can they want to get up so early in the morning and train so hard and live such a harsh life? And the answer was, that general was a very, very great motivator, inspired. I don't know why, maybe patriotism, the cause, whatever it is. Inspiring people, don't force them to do things. Inspire them so they want to do it. Yeah, we do have a democracy, but you know, I am the leader of Bodhinyana Monastery. Another monastery in the other side of Australia has started to have 2-hour meditation in the morning, 2-hour in the afternoon, 2-hour in the evening, compulsory. And if you miss 3 meditations, you can't eat. And you know, some of the monks, we were talking about this last week. So why do people do that? The only way you can get people to do things like meditate is not force them. You can sit down there, you may be thinking of all sorts of sexual fantasies for 2 hours. That's not meditating. But instead, my job is to inspire. So a person wants to get up early. They want to meditate. They can see the purpose of it. That's leadership. Not force, but inspiration, kindness. So your boss at work, if they're a really good boss, they inspire you. Look, this is a great project we're doing. It's not just making money, it's for really something good in the world, good in Australia or whatever. It really needs doing. Come on, we can do this. And if they inspire you, explain why it's really important. The money is, it's necessary, but it's not the main thing in life. You really want to do it. Make a difference. Do something which you know is going to help other people. At the end of your life, you'll be proud. I was part of that. And if someone inspires you like that, has that gift of doing that, instead of forcing and blaming and scaring you with all those terrible things which will happen if you don't follow his orders or her orders, if you can inspire people, you get so much more out of them. They really want to work. They really want to perform. They want to do the very best. That is the secret of leadership and governance. Inspiring people. It's very rare to find inspiring leaders, unfortunately. When you start thinking, which current leaders in our world today are inspiring? It's really hard to think of one, isn't it? Which is terrible. Because, that what gets you elected is your ability to con people with your promises. instead of to inspire people with your dreams and with your sort of commitment. You don't need to put it in exactly what you're going to do, but they know that they've got your backs. They really want to help. They want to, and there's nothing in it for them. Fearless, inspirational. Those are the sort of people who really should have leadership. And if we have people like that in our world, then governance will be far better. So, you know, when we entrust authority, power to other people, they will inspire us and we want to follow. Imagine a day when we want to pay our taxes. In fact, we say, I want to give more. Our Buddhist society, it runs on that donation box. You know, just things which you pay for your membership, that's a tiny bit. We run on inspiration. I run on inspiration. And this is actually where good governance comes from. Imagine that time when people say, well, I only really need to pay $100 in tax, but I'm paying $200 because this is really worthwhile. I want this hospital to be really good. I want just, I don't know, the looking after elderly people. I want it to be much better in the elderly people's homes. I'm going to be there one day. I want this care of the elderly to be really, really good. Looking after our planet, I don't care how much you give, it's important. I want to invest in this. So you pay even more taxes. Wouldn't that be wonderful? But it means the people in charge have to live. There's an inspiration to us. You know what really gets to us? People in power, they just use all this money for themselves. Corruption. And that just sucks all the energy away from governance. Corruption. Selfishness. Last little story before I finish off. To this day, there is a council in England. I forget the name of it. They follow an old tradition of about 500 or 600 years. You know, England has got all these really ancient traditions, which people sometimes think are stupid, but I think this would be a wonderful tradition to have in all levels of government in Australia and even in our Buddhist society in West Australia. Anyone elected to council, once they get elected in this one local government area in England, in front of everybody else, as a formal part of the ceremony of being elected to be a councillor, they are formally weighed to see how much they weigh. And at the end of their term in council, they are weighed again. And if their weight increases, they are fined. Because in that day, that's the only thing they could really do. They just use all their money, corruption, to get fatter and fatter and fatter. And they still do that to the day. We can do something similar like that. Everybody elected a government, see how much they're worth today. And at the end of their term of government, if they're worth more, fined. Put in jail. Taking all the money away. Whatever. So that it's nothing in it for themselves. It's only service, service, service. Unfortunately, I might fail that test and get fined. So I'm glad it's not in our monastery. Okay, so I think that's enough for this evening. Thank you for listening to Good Governance. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay, any questions? First of all, on the internet questions. Here we go. Oh, and by the way, there is a few copies of my little booklet on good governance with some of those stories in. If anyone wants to, there's some by my seat over there, you can just take them. Okay, from Germany and California. How can you stay helpful and compassionate when you feel the other person's sadness and despair without affecting your feeling of being sad too? If you see someone else who's sad and who is despairing, if you've got energy to give to them, great. Give it to them, take away some of their sadness and despair. But if it gets too much and you feel that you are getting low energy as well, then you have to go back. Similarly, if you're running a car and you find the gas is low, you've got to stop at a petrol station to fill up. Because you cannot help someone with low energy, with sadness and despair, when you're low energy too. So come to a place like this, fill up with some positive good energy, go walk by the beach, in the forest, take time out from them. So when you've got really good energy, you've got happiness to share, then you can share it with other people. So being helpful and compassionate when the other person's sadness is despair is great. When you start losing your help and compassion, your ability, your energy, you need to go and fill up, taking time out for yourself. When ordinary people turn against each other due to a political situation, what is the Buddhist way to respond and deal with that? Is actually learn how to listen to one another. Don't ever think the other person is wrong or the other people are deluded. They may be seeing something you're not, so listen to them. At the very least, they feel that their position is being respected. Because it's disrespect to one another which really divides people. You're not listening, you're not even giving me a chance to explain. And so that's where the barriers come up. Look, quite honestly, that I do know a lot of Muslims, and that's what many of the Muslims feel they're not respected. Give them a tiny bit of respect, and they will just respond with much more tolerance and kindness and try and meet other people in the middle. But when we don't respect people, you know what that's like in a relationship, you've experienced that before. Your partner does not respect you. You feel that. And that means that turns you totally away. You don't want to try anymore. So please, never deny people you disagree with. Never deny them respect. I often say the trees in the forest, all the crooked, weird trees, respect them all. They've got their place there somewhere. I don't know why sometimes, but they're there. And if you look at it in a big way, they make the forest more beautiful. So, Buddhist way to respond and deal with turning against each other due to a political situation. It is sometimes just try and respect the other person's point of view. Use the elephant simile and then try and just make a bigger view which can... First of all, as a young monk, to respect that. Listen to the person. As a young Buddhist, I was just so sectarian. Theravada, not just Theravada, Thai forest tradition. That was the best. That was the cream. Everyone else, including Sri Lankan Buddhism, Burmese Buddhism, no, you're not as good as us. No, it's just so narrow-minded. So it's great coming to Australia, out of Thailand, to a multicultural where all sorts of people come in here, not just the different types of Buddhism, the Tibetan Buddhism, hanging out with them, respecting them, different teachings sometimes, but common good heart, seeing things from their perspective as well as my perspective, Christians, Muslims, Hindus, Jews, the whole works. That's why my name, Brahm, you know what that stands for? B for Buddhist, R for Roman Catholic, A for Anglican, H for Hindu, and M for Muslim. Thank you very much. Okay. Any question from the floor before we go? Okay, it's 9 o'clock now, so it's time to go. Okay, so we can now bow 3 times. Remember, the AGM for our Buddhist Society of West Australia is Saturday week. It's only 4 members can vote, but there's still time to become a full member, maybe. I don't know. But anyway, you can come along anyway and just support us. Listen to how this place actually works. It's not run by me. It's not run by the committee. It's run by us.
Arahant Sammā Sambuddho Bhagavā Buddhaṃ Bhagavantaṃ Abhivādayaṃ Suvākkhato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammaṃ Namassāmi Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvakasaṅgho Sanghaṃ namāmi.
I can fit into one talk. But I hear that one.